Welcome to the Sharon Hour on Lagunas KX935 at this new time for the Sharon Hour, Monday nights at 9 p.m. I'm Sharon James, and I'm dedicating this particular Monday night's the Sharon Hour to going over all the propositions since tomorrow morning is midterm voting. And I'm really fortunate to have with me over the phone from her home in Ventura, the Honourable Melinda Johnson. She was for over 20 years a Superior Court judge servicing that county. She is now a mediator arbitrator for hire with the renowned JAMS organization. And I'm truly grateful that she has taken the time to go through all these propositions with me, to explain them all in detail to me and you, listener, because she has a crazy busy schedule.
Hearings, but just by phone. I have exactly 2 open days for the rest of the year when I don't have all day hearings. So.
And when I looked up your bio, it said 6 cent negotiator. So can you explain that?
You know, a lot of what I do is in the areas of family law and probate law, which is all intra-family dispute. Plus, I do a lot of employment law, sexual harassment, wrongful termination, those kinds of things, age discrimination. So a lot of times there's the issues on the surface, the obvious factual and legal issues, and a lot of times there's a lot below the surface. It turns out I do kind of have a knack for figuring out what's really driving things sometimes, as compared to what appears to be driving things.
That's wonderful. I love that. So, Prop 1.
You want me to just give you the quick summary, and then if you have questions, I can kind of do a one-minute summary of them as we go along.
Fantastic.
Okay. Prop 1 is a large bond, but it's a bond that we've passed many times before. Mostly, it involves loans. So mostly, even though we are funding those loans initially through selling bonds to the California population, most of those get repaid and go back into the general treasury. So a lot of them are for military, which, of course, in my opinion, we don't do about a tenth as much as we should do for the military. That's my editorialization here. So this has never been particularly risky. There are a few other places, and this really plays into some of the other bond issues, for low-income housing. So these also are loans intended to go to contractors who will build low-income housing. And that, of course, would also get repaid over time, so it's not so much just money going out. These are people who will commit to building multi-unit housing that would be low income for a guaranteed minimum of 35 years. So this crosses over into other areas, but this makes the construction of low-income housing more doable. Then there's a few other places. Some are for infilled areas, that is, building some low-income housing near places like transportation hubs, so people can actually live near transportation centers that can get them to work in the big city, even if they can't afford to live in the big city and that kind of thing. There's a few parts of it that are grants for some low-income first-time homeowner buyers so they can make their down payments, but most of it all is loans.
And Mindy, you're just referring now to Prop 1, or are you segueing a little into Prop 2?
This is all Prop 1.
Now, the only thing I'm hearing whispers of on this is that there is existing money for the same kind of thing that still hasn't been used. Is that...
Well, that's probably true. That's probably true. These bonds for these housing things, they come up periodically, more or less frequently, usually every, 6 to 10 years, that kind of thing. But they start putting them on the ballot when the last one is starting to run down. I think this is the 6th or 7th one that I've dealt with. So they don't want to have a gap. And remember, this just authorizes these bonds. They don't have to be sold. It authorizes them. So they sell them over time as the need arises.
I see. So this is sort of just like when you have a home equity loan, you can either use it or not use it.
Exactly.
Now, obviously, this is good for developers and good for development. Is it totally legit? I mean, is it always going to be for low income?
The whole military thing and some of the other parts of it, military housing, are long-standing public policies. So those we can kind of rely on as having a very good track record. Building the low-income housing, this is a... not brand new, but relatively new and very significant issue in the state of California. And we've not seen this part of it before. But again, you know, most of these, just like any construction loan, there's usually security for it. We're not just giving away money. All it really does, and this gets circular, but it's important to understand, I think, if we have a lower interest rate for people who would otherwise have to borrow commercially to build this kind of much-needed housing, we're kind of subsidizing it a little bit. Overall, we are socializing a bit the cost of creating low-income housing. Everyone talks about, you know, no one's incentivized to build it, the builders don't want to do it, so forth and so on, and that will come up throughout this conversation. So this is an effort, I think, to partially spread that risk, spread that cost a little bit, for the purpose of guaranteeing housing availability for a huge portion of our population so that the economy keeps on chugging. So it's all very interrelated with a lot of things.
And it seems to me, just playing devil's advocate, that some existing unused buildings maybe could be used for that.
Well, like... I think these loans can go to renovation as well as original construction.
Okay, so that's good.
Prop 2 is very interesting.
It is, isn't it?
And I have dealt with the whole mental health issue for a long, long time, particularly in the courts. I did the conservatorship calendar. I did the mental health calendar as far back as the 1970s when I was an attorney. So we passed bills in 2004 so that if you have personal income over $1 million a year, you pay a 1% extra income tax, and all that money goes to mental health programs. So this is distributed to counties. Every county has its own mental health department. Every county clearly has different kinds of issues. And the money fluctuates. You know, it can go from $1.5 billion to $2.5 billion a year. It depends on how many people have million-dollar income. So part of the law in 2004 was that there was eventually to be created some kind of component of this that allowed for therapeutic housing, supportive housing, usually multi-unit housing, where there would be actual coordination of services on site. Some social worker of some kind who would coordinate your medical, therapeutic, job placement, education services. Because one of the big problems in California is, you know, you've got 18 different things you'd like to access for someone who has got a mental illness, and just figuring out how to get them to each place at any given time and getting transportation for that is nightmarish, and people miss out on services a lot. So this housing is intended to be supportive. So the legislature, in trying to figure out exactly how to implement that part of the 2004 law, created a bill called the No Place Like Home Program. And what it does is to have a bond, it's a bond issue, again, that will sell bonds for people who will create, either from scratch or by renovating something existing, this supportive housing. And they estimate the cost will be $120 million a year to service that debt for the life of this. So what this Proposition 2 does is they want to take up to 140 so that they have a little cushion just in case the cost goes up. So they want to take up to 140 million from that mental health money to service this new bond debt. And so this is a referendum. The legislature has passed the law. They have two ways to make sure that it works, because what they have to do is pass a law that really lives up to the intent of the 2004 proposition. They think it does. So they put it on the ballot as a referendum. And if people say, yes, this is the kind of thing we had in mind when we passed Prop 63, if anyone can remember that far back, then they're fine. It can also be confirmed in the court. In fact, I think there's pending a request in the court to decide that this program, in fact, meets the purposes of Prop 63. If the electorate says it does, then the court hearing goes away. If the electorate says it does not, there's still a court possibility that the court will overrule that and say, no, we think it does.
Can you just explain referendum to me?
Yes. A referendum is, we don't get too many of them on the ballot, but we get maybe one a year or so. The legislature passes a bill, and for one reason or another, they would like to have an approval of that bill by the voters. This is not initiated by the voters like an initiative is, where people go out and collect signatures and put something on the ballot. This is the legislature putting its own action on the ballot for our approval. Sometimes it's done for, you know, highly controversial things. Sometimes it's done when they just know there's going to be a lot of litigation forever and ever, and they might as well just have the people say, no, this is what you really want or don't want. And sometimes in this one, I think they put it on because the prior legislation in 2004 suggested that this is something they had to do, and they just want you to say, you passed the first bill, people of the state of California. You said you want the money to go here. Tell us if we're spending it the right way.
And what if we say you're not?
If you say no, if the voters say no, then they still have the option of going to court and saying, I realize they said that, but they are not reading the law correctly. We want you, court, to take a look at this.
They being the legislature.
They the legislature, yeah.
Okay.
You are listening to The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, on Lagunas KX935. Tonight I'm going through all the propositions to vote on for tomorrow with my guest over the phone, the Honourable Melinda Johnson, retired Superior Court judge, now with the international organisation JAMS. We're up to Proposition 2, Housing for the Mentally Ill.
So the issues that come up from this is the people who support this proposition and say stable housing is a critical, critical part of the treatment for the mentally ill. Lack of stable housing is a death knell. It means you can barely find a way to access services. You may not be on your medication. You may deteriorate. You may wander homelessly, which leads to death. So they think that this clearly implements what was intended by this extra tax that we pay. The only group that's organized that I know don't support it is a support group for mentally ill. And their concern is really twofold. They think it takes money away from clinical therapeutic treatment. So that's a professional judgment. Do you think it really is therapeutic, or do you think it draws money away from therapy? And that up until now, Proposition 63 money has all been administered locally. It's distributed and administered locally. If you use it for this, you know, local agencies don't really have the ability to issue bonds in the same way as state does. They just don't have the infrastructure or the financial support. So if you do this and have it be spent on creating this housing through bonds, then you do take it to the state level. You take this part of the money to state administration rather than local.
And that involves a whole lot more bureaucracy, I guess, right?
No, I don't think it involves any more bureaucracy. It involves a different kind of bureaucracy.
Right.
There's a lot of bureaucracy involved in local mental health or any other local agency, as I'm sure you've experienced any time you go down to the county court's office or something. There's always bureaucracy. It's just that it would be statewide and a financial bureaucracy rather than locally and a purely clinical-focused bureaucracy.
It's weird. If they were really pro it, why don't they introduce it as a clean bill on its own? You know, let's build
a
house.
No, it's a clean bill on its own.
But it's using money that they're taking away from treatment, right?
No, you might feel that way. Most professionals don't feel that way. Most professionals think this is a critical part of treatment. Stable, supportive housing is essential to treating the mentally ill. Their homelessness, their inability to access services is what prevents them from ever becoming functional in society. And so they think this is therapeutic and that this is exactly what was intended in 2004, and this is a good way to implement it.
Okay.
It's a very small group who oppose it. You know, I speak to a lot of mental health professionals on cases all the time. I would say the great majority are in favor of this use of the money. I tell you what, they spend a lot of money and time tracking down their clients, trying to find them to help them. This could really be a boon. And remember that Prop 63 did have this kind of component, that we need to have something like this eventually. It's just a question of how we execute it.
Right. I mean, when they closed all the institutions, they should have implemented this right away, right?
Well, that was when Ronald Reagan was governor.
Exactly, I know.
That was a long time ago.
It was a long time ago, but it was, you know, repercussions exist to this day. It's terrible.
They certainly do.
You're tuned to KX935's The Sharer Now with me, Sharon James, and my guest tonight, the Honourable Melinda Johnson, who's kindly taking us through all the propositions for tomorrow's vote. We're up to Proposition 3.
In its entirety. This is, I think, the longest one on the ballot. Everyone who really knows California knows it's all about water. Every fight we've had for the time since we became a state and before has been about water. So we have to marshal and use our water much more efficiently than someone like, for example, in Florida, where it just rains all the time, and they're thrilled. I took a cruise recently, and there were people from Florida who were just dying because of the rain was killing them while we were in the middle of a drought. And I said, we'll buy your water. Just find a way to get it to us. And they said, we'll give you our water. We don't want, we too much take it. So it's always been about water, and we've had propositions ever since I've been a child about this. And at one point, you know, there was the desalination, so I tried to take the water out of the ocean. Then there was, we're going to actually harness a glacier in the Arctic and bring it down here, and we'll have all that water, which I think that ship has failed too. So this is a very detailed proposition that authorizes bonds, and this is one that's not going to go out on loans. This is just payment. This is almost $9 billion in bonds. It just goes out for the benefit of everybody to preserve, enhance, marshal, whatever you want to call it, the water that we have and that we can get from the watersheds, from the snow and the rain and so forth, and the groundwater. We have a lot of groundwater problems in this state, a lot of contamination in groundwater. So what it does is to, in great detail, go over every single project for which this is going to be spent, and there's a budget for each part. Part of it is for collecting and cleaning rainwater and recycling water and so forth to create safe drinking water. Part of it is to protect the watershed. Part of it is for canal and dam improvements, et cetera, et cetera. There's a budget for everything. This has the typical cost of any bond. And like all the bond propositions, here's what everyone needs to know. They all have a dollar amount. They all have a lifespan. They all project what they will cost per year to service. This one is $430 million a year, which is about a third of a percent of our general revenue. It's a lot of money, not proportionately maybe as much money. Most of it goes to local agencies. Most of it goes to local water districts, nonprofit organizations, et cetera. When they give money to local agencies, they require matching funds generally. That is, you say you have a $2 million project, we will grant you $1 million from our bond sales, but you have to pony up $1 million. So everybody has skin in the game. That's also a typical way these dollars are spent. Then they all have oversight requirements, written into them oversight requirements, a limitation on the amount that can be spent for administration, how the accounting is done, and so forth. I can't comment on how well those are done. I'm assuming that there's litigation periodically when someone doesn't like the way it's done or feels it's not been done at all. But that's how these are all written. Sales authorized, budgeting to where they're spent, limitation on administration costs, and accounting over time. So this is the same kind of structure as any other bond issue. The big objection to it seems to be from a group who feels that really much more money needs to be spent on dams. Right. And in fact, there's not a lot of money regarding dams in here comparatively. Yeah. There's only a few dams that are specifically targeted.
I think just one dam, they're saying.
I think there's more than one. There's $472 million targeted for, quote, surface water storage and dam repair. This has to do with reservoirs and dams and so forth. Here's the problem everybody faces when they get these kinds of propositions, and this comes up in so many of them, not just bond issues. If you were designing the perfect bond issue related to water issues, and you really understood it well, which I don't even pretend that I do, I have a superficial understanding of it, you would put X dollars in this bucket and X dollars in that bucket and so forth. But if 100 of you are together, probably not all of you are going to agree on that. Everyone's going to have their pet projects and their pet peeves. And so this is what legislation is like. You start trading off. You know what? I'll back off on this one if you'll back off on that one. I really feel this one's important. I'll give you your pet project if you give me mine. And it's not a bad thing. It's not something nefarious. It's the way compromises get made. So I always tell people when they're looking at these, you are negotiating with yourself. Is this a bill that overall you think is a good one, despite its flaws? Is it a bill that has something that you really, really, really want, and so you'll overlook a lot of flaws to get there? Or is it on balance one that just doesn't have any of the things you think are important, or very few of them, and it's got a lot of things you don't think are important? So it's always about, the opposition does not provide us with a comprehensive alternative. They do complain, and it's probably a legitimate question, about the lack of money for dams. And I won't say that they're wrong, but you have to look at it on balance and make a decision.
Right. And water really is the oil of our future, you know. So, I mean, anything that gives it a profile.
It's everything.
Yeah. So maybe this is a start, at least, right?
I don't think it's a start. I think it's a continuation of where we've been. But clearly, we have gone through extraordinary droughts, two in a row. They've led to extraordinary fires and other cataclysmic events and sequelae from those fires that are far beyond what they ever were before. So it's not something that can be ignored.
Exactly. Would this bill give allowance to spend more on the dams if they wanted to use the money that way?
It has a budget. It has a budget. And the budget leaves a relatively small amount for dams. Whether they can move the money around or not, one of the reasons they give you a budget is because they want you to know what it is your money is going to be spent for. So it doesn't prevent them from perhaps next 2 years having a bond issue just for dams. Maybe they look close and say, you know what, we fouled up and we need to ask for more money for dams, or we need to ask to divert money to dams or something like that. But they give you a budget for a reason, so you can decide, do these priorities look pretty good to me or not?
I see. Good, okay. Well, I think anything to do with water, probably, we have to spend money on.
Remember the movie Chinatown? It's all about water.
That's right.
Too true. You're tuned to The Sharer now with me, Sharon James, on Gunas KX 935. Tonight, we have the honour of having with us the Honourable Melinda Johnson, retired Superior Court judge now with the international organisation JAMS. She's taking us through all the propositions. We're up to Prop 4.
The one that's just not even opposed by anybody. This is a bond to construct children's hospitals. Most of them are private, non-profit. A few of them are California state UC places. And this has passed many times before. These are for children who have severe, serious physical problems that, honestly, they would die without these hospitals. So it's really never been opposed. It's $1.5 billion, which is a considerable amount of money, but not as large as the others. And it's the kind of thing that's been passed before. There just really isn't any opposition to it. I'm sure there's someone who was going to vote no for it, but there's no organized opposition. The Howard Jarvis Association says we should use this money to pay for the unfunded pension for grammar school teachers and secondary school teachers. I don't know. The Jarvis Association has its point of view, and it's always a leader in opposing anything that creates new taxes. But that's the only kind of organized opposition that I've seen.
Well, except let me just pose this. I don't think in England we have specific children's hospitals. Maybe we do. But why isn't it all hospitals? Because it just seems that the minute they throw out something like children or animals or anything, everybody is going to feel terrible if they oppose it. But I mean, definitely hospitals are needed and more hospitals. But why just children's hospitals?
California has a long history of having dedicated children's hospitals because childhood leukemia is not like adult leukemia. Childhood diseases of all kinds are not like adult diseases, even the same disease. So we have a long history of research and teaching hospitals, largely identified with the University of California, some of them nonprofits. And you're right, you know, you put dogs and little kids in something and you get a very positive reaction, and perhaps that is part of the thinking here. But these hospitals have long preceded these bond measures. These are not being created to do this. And most of them are children who, you know, some of them have Medi-Cal and Medicaid. It's just really, you have a choice between paying for these children's services with Medi-Cal and Medicaid, which is one way to do it, or doing it through bonds, which maybe socializes the issue a bit more, maybe spreads the risk a bit more. Yeah, it's an emotional grabber, but these hospitals are not created for that purpose. They have long existed.
And they're public hospitals, not private ones?
Some are private nonprofits. They're either private nonprofits. I mean, it's not going to go to a for-profit hospital. They're either private acute care children's hospitals, UC. I think that's where they are.
Okay. And yeah. Just for my edification, is there a point for separating children from adults in hospitals?
Well, the only point I know of is that all pediatricians will tell you childhood illnesses are not the same as adult illnesses, even if they're the same diagnosis. They're just handled completely differently. Just the nature of the patients, not even the nature of the way the disease affects them, but the nature of the patients, the ability to have, you know, waiting rooms, extra waiting rooms, family rooms for parents of three-year-olds, that kind of thing. They just have a very different environment. Pediatrics is not the same as adult medicine. And that's just a decision that was made a long time ago in terms of creating these hospitals at all. Most of the UC systems that have these kinds of hospitals also have regular adult teaching hospitals as well. But this just goes to the children.
You're listening to The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935, going through the propositions for tomorrow's voting with the Honourable Melinda Johnson, retired Superior Court judge now with JAMS. We're at Prop 5.
Give me the history here. So Proposition 13 passes in 1978. And this is an initiative, honestly, created by the Jarvis Association, our Jarvis Association. It was mostly supported by and created by rental property owners, landlords. It was not individual homeowners who pressed this. We have benefited from it, but we didn't press it. So this said people get forced out of their homes because the property taxes can just go up infinitely, and you can't pay it, and you're out, and, you know, it's terrible. So Proposition 13 says your taxes are frozen at this level. That's your base. They can only go up a small percentage every year, 2% a year, until the property is resold. So what happens with Prop 13 is that the people of the state of California and the people of each individual county lose money year after year after year, while the houses you're in are hugely increasing in value, but you're not paying proportionate property taxes. And they only catch up with that when you sell the house. So the next person who buys a house, they get their appraisal. Their base now is at much higher rate. That $100,000 house is now sold for $700,000 30 years later. And so we're going to now start recapturing the true property taxes. So everyone said that's fine, except there are certain people who sometimes need to transfer out of those houses into other houses, and they should be able to take their Prop 13 base also along with them. So people over 55, people who are disabled, people whose houses have been destroyed in natural disasters, get to take the property tax base, the old low one, and move it to another home, as long as it's the same or lesser value. And this happens when older people want to downsize, older people want to move closer to where their children and grandchildren are, this kinds of things, disabled homeowners, the same thing. So everyone said, you know what, we will, as a society, bite the bullet a while longer, not capture the true tax benefit that should flow from that house, and allow you, certain people, to move as long as, you know, you're doing it for the reasons that we talked about, you're not just doing it willy-nilly. So this proposition allows those same people who are over 55 or disabled or homeowners of destroyed houses to transfer their base to an even more expensive home. So you will capture some additional property tax for the excess. If you have a $500,000 home you're selling and you're buying a $600,000 home, we're going to apply the new current rate to that extra $100,000. But you're going to keep that low rate for the $500,000 that was the old house's value.
And as it exists right now, Mindy, you have to buy something of the same value or lower, right?
Correct, correct, in order to get this benefit. So what this says is that as a society, you are still going to delay capturing the full property tax value of that house for yet a while longer. The question is, why would you agree to do that if there's someone who's actually buying a more expensive house? That's the opposition of this. You know, what if you're a 55-year-old person and you have $1 million house and you want to buy $1.3 million house? You're still going to keep that basis on $1 million. You're just going to pay extra on the $300,000. So the society as a whole is going to bear the cost of the delay in that. And you never recapture it. It's not like you ever go back and pick up the lost tax.
Yes.
You just start afresh later. So what this does is just delay the ability of the society as a whole to benefit from the true taxable value of the property. So, depending upon how you feel about Prop 13, there you go.
Well, I will put my two cents in here because I just think these things should not be rote. I see no reason for it. That should be means tested on an individual basis.
Well, that ship has sailed. failed, because Prop 13 has nothing to do with means tests, and in fact,
I know, but I think it should
probably benefit the well-to-do more than the low-income. You know, you buy your house and you stay in it for a long time, you're well-to-do, and you're paying very little taxes, whereas the people who are on lower income tend to have to move more frequently and so forth. So, yeah, it's a counter-egalitarian or counter-means test proposition altogether.
Yeah, and I know so many wealthy people who are benefiting from Prop 13, and it's just not right. I mean,
I absolutely am. I've been living in my house since 1975.
I know, yeah. And I mean, even if it would, you know, I'm over 55, it would, these things are for my benefit, but I don't think they should be. I mean, I think the younger ones, it, you know, more money needs to go into the economy if people can afford it. And fine, on an individual basis, if you can prove that you require it because you're disabled or there's some better reason, fine, do it on a means-tested basis, but not by rote, I think.
Well, yeah, anyway. And that's an entirely different argument, which is not on the ballot and which I don't expect to be on the ballot for a long time. Prop 13 has become iconic in the state, and I don't see that going away for a long time.
And this enhances it, so...
Yeah, this does exacerbate the negative effect.
Exactly right.
Quick introduction here to say you are tuned to KX935's The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, and my guest, the Honourable Melinda Johnson, former Superior Court judge, now with JAMS, taking us through all the propositions. We're up to Proposition 6.
Prop 6 is fascinating. So California, if it's not about water, it's about transportation, because we are a huge state and people have to travel a long way to get to work and to school and to family. So we have always used, along with some general fund money, gasoline, sales taxes and excise taxes, fuel, gasoline and diesel, to fund road repair and transportation. And the legislature passed a bill in 2017 that increased the cost per gallon for these, increased the excise tax, for the purpose of having money for road repair and public transportation. California, as you know, we do a lot of things very well. Public transportation is not one of them.
Right.
And for a number of reasons, we just felt a long time ago we were too big, didn't need it, lots of space, compared to some place like New York or Boston where they really got to have public transportation to get around at all. We just thought, no problem, we'll just drive. So we have all these roads and we need better public transportation, and that's how we fund it. So this proposition is really interesting. It's very draconian. It may be the shortest proposition. It just says that it eliminates taxes for this, and what it really is referring to is the raise that we just had passed, and it requires voter approval for any taxes and fees in the future. It's a constitutional amendment that not only repeals the taxes the legislature just passed in 2017, but prevents the legislature from ever passing any additional fuel taxes without, it has to be a vote of the people. It's a constitutional amendment. That's true. So it is true that gasoline taxes are a regressive tax. There's no question about it. And it is also true that having all taxes have to be passed by a vote of the people will probably mean there will never be any again. Very hard to get people to do that, particularly on gasoline. So it's very draconian. It's very draconian.
Draconian in that if you vote yes, you're taking money away from road, yes?
You're taking a huge amount of money away from roads and bridges and public transportation.
Yes.
And you are preventing the legislature from ever passing that again.
That's pretty outrageous.
Well, depends on how you feel about the roads. I mean, you know, we hear a lot about infrastructure. California has traditionally taxed itself to pay for infrastructure more than most.
But here's the thing. We're taxing the people who are using the roads. We're not taxing the people who are using public transportation. Oh, well, public transportation that isn't to do with roads, right?
We're not taxed by this method. No, that's correct. But on the other hand, we don't have a lot of public transportation. Yeah, it's a user. It's similar to a kind of a user fee. That is true.
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons. See how these things all play together. One of the things they want to pay for with the Prop 1 bond, the housing bond, is infilling low-income housing near public transportation facilities so that people can use public transportation to get to work from their housing rather than drive their cars. These are very related. All of these are very related.
You're listening to The Sharon Hour, and me, Sharon James, on Laguna's KX935. My guest tonight is the Honourable Melinda Johnson. She used to be a Superior Court judge. She is now with the international organisation JAMS. And she's kindly going through all the propositions with us. We're up to Prop 7.
Prop 7 is very entertaining. All this, I gave the award for the most wishy-washy initiative ever. All this says is the federal government controls whether we can have daylight savings time or non-daylight savings time. We all had to opt in at some point, and we opted to have a bifurcated year. Some states did not. We did.
Oh, some states did not? Is that true? I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a couple of them. I think Arizona doesn't have a shift, and I don't think Hawaii has a shift.
Oh, okay.
And I think we opted in when this first came up.
Okay.
So all this proposition says is that if the federal government passes a law that allows us to shift to all daylight savings time or all standard time, that the legislature can consider it. It doesn't require them to do anything. It depends on a federal law passing, and then the legislature gets to consider it. So it gives them more consent to consider adopting this, and then they'll do what they want to do.
Exactly.
It's really funny. But my favorite is the pro-argument is A, less confusion. B, there are medical consequences when you have this shift every year on the days right around the time change. There are more heart attacks, more strokes, and so forth, which is true of any significant change. I mean, I don't doubt that for a minute, and that happens in all significant change. The opposition is, if you go to daylight savings time all year to save energy, the children will be walking to school in the dark. And the more important opposition comes from my state senator, Beth Art Jackson, who says, if California wants to do it, the federal government will say no anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
Will say no? Do you think so?
Yeah.
Because
California says, we want to do this, the federal government will immediately say no.
That's true, under this administration anyway. I mean, certainly our circadian rhythms are affected, you know, when any of us travel abroad. I mean, it takes a long time to get, and it was mainly for farmers, and there are hardly any farmers anymore.
I know.
At least the kind that we grew up with.
The school year is for farmers, you know. Why do we get out in June and go back in September because of harvest?
Right, exactly. Okay, so that's pretty straightforward. I mean, as you say,
you know,
it's a first step. And it's a shame it came up in this particular midterm.
Why it got on this bill, I don't know.
But if it does get knocked down, then maybe a stronger bill will come up next time enough people vote for it.
I don't know that there is a stronger bill, because until the federal government changes it, there's nothing we can do to require us to go one way or the other.
Right. Okay, so Prop 8 seems complicated, this kidney dialysis.
Prop 8 is unbelievably complicated, and it's got its superficial layer and its underneath layer. Kidney dialysis treatments are mostly done in local centers, but they're not locally owned. Most of them are owned by just a couple of companies. They're huge, huge nationwide companies. They do one thing that I suppose is not unusual and probably not unique to them. They charge Medicare what they can, because that's all they can, and then they charge private pay or private insurance people much, much more because they can. Because they're not limited in the same way Medicare is. So part of this is to equalize that. Part of it is because, although they appear to be local, they really are big organizations, to limit their profits. So right off the bat, we've got a very controversial goal.
Yes.
And they can charge no more than 115% of their direct cost. And their direct cost is very specifically defined about what it means. And a lot of things are listed. Some things are not listed. There's no management component, for example. So
no management.
In the direct cost. The proposition lists what they can have as direct cost. If they have $100 in direct cost, all they can charge is $115. How you define direct cost is part of the controversy.
Right.
Whether their profit should be limited is another part of the controversy. But what this does is to say everything that is in excess of it has to be rebated.
Right.
Presumably refunded, presumably to either the private pay patient or the insurance company. So there is an extraordinary amount of bookkeeping involved here. Who gets rebated, how much? You have to figure it out for different kinds of patients. You have to figure, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work.
Yes.
It can certainly be done, but it's going to add to the administrative cost, certainly. So the argument is, all of the above. One, if this adds a lot of regulations to something that's already fairly regulated, any medical care facility, it adds a lot of costs to a process that's already expensive, and it limits profits, and we are a capitalist society. So the people who propose it say that the companies are simply not very well run on an on-the-ground level. They're not clean enough. The staff isn't trained enough. You can find cockroaches and bloodstains around and so forth. I don't know if all that's true. You'll see pictures. I'm certain that they have evidence of it. How widespread it is, I have no idea. But all those kinds of things, cleaning, training, et cetera, are part of direct costs. So this is, the proponents say, is to incentivize the companies to invest in better training of staff, in better upkeep of the facilities, and so forth. The proponents say that they actually mark up 350%, so that's really, really large.
When you say proponents, opponents, a yes vote actually means that you would be limiting.
You limit their profits, but you increase their incentive to incur the direct costs, which don't get counted against profits, in training and cleanliness and upkeep and so forth. So that's how it superficially looks. So decent goals by the proponents, very complex and very expensive consequences if you fail. There are large interest rates if you don't make the rebates correctly on time. There can be criminal prosecution. It's complicated and expensive if you don't live up to the demands of this proposition. So the opponents, which are the companies, the Coalition of Dialysis Providers, they say that this is really just being promoted by the unions to give them a leverage. It is true that the unions have been trying to unionize, and they have been unsuccessful, and they will tell you that they're suffering tremendous retaliation by making any union effort. But they will also tell you that one of the reasons they want to unionize is for patient protection, and the patients are not getting the best treatment, and somebody's being gouged, be it your private insurance company or somebody. So there's this subtext about, and the biggest opponents are, in fact, the unions, and the biggest opponents are the companies. So it doesn't seem to have generated a lot of financial interest in anyone of the people directly involved with these companies. It's very interesting, and if you try to unionize and you're retaliated these days, there should be enforcement against that. I suspect that the budget for that has probably gone down to about zero under the current administration. So this is generated by the unions who are seeking to unionize, but they will say not just for our benefit, for the patients. It's opposed by the dialysis providers who will say that this is going to limit access to patients because the work that we have to do and the small profit that we'll have by the time we finish all that work will really prevent us from offering services. So there are a lot of African-American and Latino organizations who oppose it because these are neighborhood facilities. And if you don't have a neighborhood facility and you have to get yourself to a hospital to do this, it's difficult. It's difficult. And so it's very controversial, very complex.
Okay, so just to qualify, no means everything stays the same. They don't have to rebate.
Correct.
They don't have to do anything.
Correct.
And yes means they do have to change. The unions are the yes votes.
You're listening to The Sharon Hour on Lagunas KX 935. I'm Sharon James, and I have as my guest tonight over the telephone the Honourable Melinda Johnson, former Superior Court Judge in Ventura, now with the international organisation JAMS. She's running us through all the propositions, and we're up to Prop 10, which I personally was having a hard time with.
Okay, so I'll tell you what Prop 10 actually does, and then I'll tell you what the arguments about it seem to be. We have a law in California, about 20-plus years old, that affirmatively forbids any local government from imposing rent control on anything built after 1995, okay? As another rule for condos, but let's just worry about this. So almost all rent control everywhere you know about in the country is local. It's a city council kind of decision. New York City has it. Santa Monica has it. It's not a statewide law. Usually it's local. Local municipalities cannot, after 1995, impose any rent control on anything built after 1995. So this proposition repeals that law and allows local governments to enact rent control if they wish, which is important to note. This law does not put rent control onto the books, period. All it does is give local entities the opportunity to enact rent control provisions of whatever kind if they choose to do so. The only limitation on it is that the landlord must receive a fair rate of return. That is a phrase that's used in all rent control provisions. It's otherwise undefined. I don't know what it exactly means. Clearly, landlords are not happy about this because they don't want someone else deciding what the fair rate of return. The argument in support of this is very much a social justice, public health kind of argument. Community is hurt when there are homeless, not the mentally ill, but there are people who are working full-time, cannot afford housing at all. We did a survey in Ventura County several years ago when I was very involved with a nonprofit that helps the homeless and found that the majority of the people in the county work for minimum wage. And even with two people, two spouses, who have maybe one child, they want to have a two-bedroom apartment, working full-time minimum wage jobs, they could not rent a two-bedroom apartment at market rates, period. So this is the housing crisis that we talked about with Proposition 1. So the proponents are arguing, you know, basic shelter is a human right. It's not some just a commodity. It's more than that. It's a human right. We're not talking about a legal right or a constitutional right, just a human right. And the market has simply not responded. Low-income housing should be something that there should be a market for, but builders aren't interested in it. So it's a very slow response to even begin this, and it takes a long time. And the carrot, so this is like the stick, right? Prop 10 allows people to have rent control. The carrot is Prop 1, those low-interest loans that we talked about in the very beginning of our conversation, for developers, for landlords, to build and develop low-income housing. So if the cost of construction is lowered because of low-interest loans, the rent should be able to be lowered as well, so the landlord doesn't have to collect as much to get that fair rate of return. So this is a partial socializing of the problem. There'll be private builders, but the burden will be spread among all of us with low interest housing and to the builders with low rent. And the opposition then, so they're speaking a little bit past each other, is a capitalist one. You know, we are a capitalist society. This should be left to private business. Government should not be stepping in to either encouraging it or setting the rate of return. That's just not government's job. And if you limit a landlord's profit, they're going to not want to get into this business, and so you'll probably shrink the housing supply. So this is a very much a public policy, moral values decision for voters to make, bearing in mind what it does. It gives the option to impose rent control. It doesn't require it. It doesn't allow it automatically. It goes to whatever local political processes every city, every county has to make those kinds of decisions. But it's really very, very value-laden.
But does it allow the local community to designate a particular building as rent control?
Well, every rent control law will be written as it's written. And there are usually constitutional reasons why you can't interfere with existing contracts. So if you have a contract to rent your apartment house out for, you know, $5,000 a unit, as long as those renters are there, no one's going to be able to interfere with that. When you get new renters, perhaps rent control can go into place. These are not easy to write. These involve a lot of competing interests.
Right.
Like all complex legislation, there will be debate back and forth. There will be, you know, some experimental ones and maybe some model efforts. Let's try this neighborhood, or let's try a small portion of things and see how it goes, that kind of thing, and see if it works. It will be a long time implementing, and it will be a lot of technical and legal and policy decisions that go into it, if any community decides to do it.
Well, let's say there's a somewhat decrepit building that has a duplex or a fourplex in it, and you buy it, and you do it up, and you go to rent it, and the council comes in and says, we're slapping rent control on this building. Is that a possible scenario?
Well, first of all, nobody slaps rent control on anybody. There has to be legislation passed in advance of you renting. As I said, if you're renting to someone already, there are constitutional reasons why they can't interrupt that contract or interfere with that contract. You could, in fact, purchase something, and before you have rented it out, a rent control law goes into effect, and you would be bound by it. That
okay.
is possible.
So they can initiate a rent control on something you bought without knowing that it was going to be under rent control, yes?
It is possible. This will, no doubt, while that conversation is going on, inhibit people from buying rental properties so they know what's going to happen.
Right.
Because the price of a rental property is usually determined by its income stream. So if I've got a property I think is $1 million worth because you can rent all these units for $5,000 a month, and you'd say, well, I'm afraid I'm going to be limited to $3,500 before very long, so it's not worth what you say it is. The income stream is different. It will go into the negotiation of prices, and it may inhibit some sales while it's pending.
Well, I tell you why I bring it up.
What it is.
Because it makes sense that there is some low-income housing. But I had a neighbor in New York who inherited the brownstone next to where I lived. And it was a 5-story brownstone with 10 apartments, 2 per floor, which is usual in New York. And she inherited that from her parents, and it was rent control. And she couldn't get enough from the rent to keep that house in upkeep.
So those are the horror stories you hear. That's why one of the important phrases here is that the landlord must receive a fair rate of return. Now, rate of return means after all expenses are considered, you should have a profit margin.
Okay.
That's the rate of return. So I have no idea how the New York laws are written, and I know it has got a lot of rent-controlled areas. This one is meant to avoid that, and so that's when you write the legislation. You know, it's going to have language in it that says your allowable cost, just like the allowable cost in the dialysis thing, the basis of what you paid for, what it costs you to service the mortgage on it, what the utilities are that you pay, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then you get a fair rate of return. So those are all the considerations that go into that. What happened in that story really shouldn't happen, but, you know, you can take the do-gooder approach that really is a human right, and you can take the capitalist approach that communities are better off when we're all well-housed, all adequately housed.
And that there should be some diversity within a community.
There's a lot of social reasons, yeah.
Yeah.
You're tuned to Cakes 935's The Sharon Hour with me, Sharon James, and tonight my guest over the phone, Melinda Johnson, retired Superior Court judge, now with the international organization JAMS, and she's running us through the propositions that we're going to vote on tomorrow. We're up to Prop 11.
In California, you are required to give hourly employees very specific meal breaks and rest breaks. After a certain number of hours of work, you get a rest break and you get a meal break, and you have to really get on break. You're not on call. You can't be called back to work. You get to leave the premises if you want and really go away and rest. And if you don't get those, then the employer has to pay you for it. So there's a recent case that was decided in California that basically says you have got to enforce this time off. You cannot require people to be on call during meal and rest breaks, period, no matter what. I think that's been a law for a long time, but apparently it's made very, very clear in this case. So the people who own medical response teams, ambulance things, said, you know, we can't staff our place like this. We got people, they may be sitting around playing cards for a while, it may be during their lunch hour or whatever, but when we get a call, we got to go. Period. We got to go. And so we want to be able to absolutely interrupt their meal breaks and their lunch breaks. Yes, we'll pay them for that hour that they missed the meal break. Yes, maybe an extra hour, whatever. But we have to have them be interruptible. And so both the people who own those companies and the people who work for those companies are very much in favor of this. They want to overrule that decision so that they can all be on call no matter what, not enforce those automatic breaks.
And apparently there's no argument against it. So
Not really.
Straightforward. Okay, so it wasn't Prop 10 that was so confusing to me. I just put a question mark because I wasn't sure.
Prop 12.
Exactly.
Yeah, I know. So Prop 12 is extremely confusing. And this is one that I've done the most research outside of the legislation itself and just my own past knowledge, because I don't purport to understand what is best for these animals. I am very happy to vote for whichever is best for these animals.
Exactly.
I just don't really know what it is. This is the kind of thing usually you'd have it in the legislature. There'd be testimony. You'd have experts. We'd know something about it. Here we're just having to rely on kind of the summaries that people give us. Here's what I know. We passed Prop 2 in 2008, a different proposition, and it banned confinement for pregnant pigs, egg-laying hens, and calves raised at field. They had to be given enough room to turn around, lie down, spread their legs, etc. There was no size kind of specified, there was just a definition based on their behavior. So this replaces that with specific square footage. In the proposition we passed in 2008, by a certain period of time, and I think of 2015, hens had to be in a cage-free system. Under this one, that is modified so that as of 2021, so there's a delay, they have to be in a, quote, cage-free housing system. That is a term of art, I think, created by the egg industry. And when you see the kind of diagrams of what it means, it looks like, I call them hen condos. They don't each have a specific amount of space. There's various floors. There's ramps they can walk up and down so that they're kind of walking around and exercising. And you divide all that space by the number of hens that are in there, and you come up with the allowable amount of space, I guess. So I just think of them as condos for chickens. So it's very difficult for me to tell if this is better for the animals or worse. It's certainly more specific, so it's easier to enforce. There's not an argument about, well, you know, the pigs can lie down in this amount of space. No, they can't. It's okay if you're a really small pig, not if you're a medium-sized pig, yada, yada, yada. So it's easier to enforce when you have specifics. And the second part of this law is that enforcement moves from the local agencies, where there's maybe more discretion, maybe it's less uniform over the state, to the State Department of Food and Agriculture and the State Department of Public Health. So this creates more uniformity, but it also creates less direct relationships between the regulators and the farmers. It might not work so well together. So the Humane Society has supported this. PETA opposes it, says the Humane Society is basically getting packed with the devil and so forth. It's really hard for me to know. The other opposition is that based on the law that was passed in 2008, a lot of farmers completely redid all of their facilities to comply with that. And now they're going to have to. They say, you reneged on the deal. You told us what to do. We spent a lot of money. We did it to meet those standards. Makes the food cost more. Now you want us to redo it completely because you didn't like the way you did it in 2008. So, I understand their position. That is a problem. But if I knew the answer of what was best, I can't tell. I read a lot of things. Most of the editorials are coming out in favor of it, but I don't know what to say. I, what I know is when I read this, I feel like I want to be a vegetarian. It just sounds
I know.
About this stuff. In all honesty, as a good person, I ought to be a vegetarian. The one argument I'm not thrilled about is the pork producers say these decisions should be made by farmers who know what they're doing, not animal rights opinion people. Okay. So there's your value analysis. Who should be making that decision? People who profit by it, animal rights people, you take your pick. And I haven't found anything that helps me enough to really know what's better for the animal.
If you just went by the issue of fairness, forgetting that it's animals, cages, whatever.
We eat them in the end, yeah.
And we eat them in the end. But the point is there was legislation passed that we agreed we would ban these cages by 2015, and now they're backtracking it.
They're backtracking that, but they're also backtracking on what they told the farmers that they had to build for the pigs and the veal, you know, what they thought was enough for them to spread their limbs and lie down and so forth, and now we're changing that too.
That's what I mean. It is reneging, and actually, under this law, if you voted yes, they're only getting an extra square foot anyway.
Well, there was no footage specified before. That's the point. There wasn't. So I don't know that they're getting one extra square foot. I don't know what they're getting. They're getting a specific square footage.
They
never had that before.
Okay.
And I don't know what these cages or what these facilities or pens look like. I don't know, how big is the average one now? How much is that different from what this bill would require?
So if we're on the fence, should we just vote for fairness?
You figure out where your fairness lies. I mean, that's really what it is. You have to figure out this like the rent control one, is a values decision. It's truly a values decision.
Yeah, but we don't know, you know, which value. Even with the best values, it's still confusing as to whether we should vote yes or no.
It's not confusing. It's just not clear. It's not informative enough.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, gosh, thank you so much, Mindy. It's been very helpful.
The wonderful former Superior Court judge, the Honourable Melinda Johnson, helping us figure out the propositions for tomorrow's vote. Go do it, everybody. This is Sharon James of KX935's The Sharon Hour. My show podcasts on iTunes or on our dedicated website, kx935.com/shows/the-sharon-hour. That's sharing without the G, hour with the H. If you're on air in Laguna, KX935 does give emergency alerts, etc. So do always tune in and please come back and listen to me again next Monday night at 9 p.m. my new time. This is Sharon James wishing you a great voting experience, and may your wishes come true.